3, 2, 1. We're back. It's like magic. Do any of you listen to Car Talk on National Public Radio? Click and Clack the Tappet Brothers. Do you know the Shameless Commerce Division of Car Talk? Well, this is the Shameless Commerce Division of the Franciscan World. I work for an organization called CFIT, the Commission on the Franciscan International Intellectual Tradition, and we do things like put all of the early Franciscan sources for free on the internet. And we've done volume one of Francis, Early Documents, that three-volume series. We've done Clare of Assisi, Early Documents. And now, just about 2 weeks ago, we started to see, finally coming online, a big project we've been doing, volume two of Francis of Assisi, Early Documents. This is the volume called The Founder, and it includes the major life of St. Francis by St. Bonaventure, and also the second life of St. Francis called The Remembrance of the Desire of a Soul, by Thomas of Celano, and a lot of other fun and interesting stuff. So, for those of you who are interested in reading this, it's available online. For those of you who are very high-tech, this is now mobile, so this is adapted for your smartphone or for your tablet. Here it is, and if Michael in the back would click on where it says Join Us. Let's see if we can get Join Us. This little green tab right there. The website and the use of the resources is all free, but we want to know that you're a human being and not a bot or a Russian. So, well, Russians would be welcome, Russian Franciscans, of course. So you need to put in your name and an email, and you need to make up a password. You need to tell us at least what city and what country you live in. That helps us tell what the distribution of our readership is right now. The highest distribution is in Kenya and the Philippines, where books are very expensive, but people have cell phones. So they read the Franciscan sources on their cell phones. You need to do a little exercise here, the famous CAPTCHA. So you have to figure out what those letters and numbers say, and then we realize you are not an evil machine. You are a good Franciscan person. So then you sign up. If we could go back now to the top where it says Early Sources, you click there, and you'll see that we have Clare of Assisi, Francis and Clare of Assisi Early Documents. Michael, if you would click on Francis the Saint, that's the first volume of our series. Now click on Francis the Founder. This is the one that just started going online 2 weeks ago. So we have a lot of people working on this. And if you click on Clare the Lady, this is the complete works of St. Clare and early documents about St. Clare, all available online. Just have to register, free service from your happy commission on Franciscan intellectual tradition. All right, I think we're finished with that, Michael. Thank you very much. Oh, go back. Go back to the first one. Click. That's the first one. Oh, back to the slide with the web address. Okay, the web address is FranciscanTradition, all one word, .org, O-R-G. That means we're a not-for-profit, and believe me, we are not-for-profit. You don't have to draw any lines. Actually, all that you have to do is just type Franciscan Tradition, one word, and if you have a smart computer, it'll figure it out. Even your phone will figure it out. It'll go to the website. Who's paying for all of this? Well, we get grants from the Academy of American Franciscan History. We get grants from the English-speaking Conference of the Friars. We get donations from people. And we have a lot of very good volunteers who love Francis and Franciscan things. Many of them are former graduate students of Father Wayne Hellman, conventual friar at St. Louis University. They do this for free. So, yeah, we have great friends. All right, are you ready for a little bit more work now? This is David Bornstein. He's not a Franciscan. I'm not sure that he's a Catholic. He's a writer. He is the author of a work called How to Change the World, Social Entrepreneurs and the Power of New Ideas. And the book was published by Oxford University Press in 2007. I didn't know anything about Mr. Bornstein or his book until someone said to me, "Do you know that St. Francis is famous in the world of social enterprise?" And this comes from one of my brothers who works in the Center for Social Enterprise at Santa Clara University. And here is a quotation from that book. "St. Francis of Assisi, the founder of the Franciscan order, would qualify as a social entrepreneur." Didn't you know that? "Having built multiple organizations that advanced pattern changes in his field." That's the definition of a social entrepreneur. Somebody who makes an important contribution in his field that actually changes the pattern. It changes the way people do things. So this is coming from an outside secular source looking for examples of how people have changed things for the sake of the common good. And he came up with the example of St. Francis. So what I would like to point out in this last presentation is how we move from our individual following of the word of the gospel, making it take flesh through deed or example, and how we might think more structurally, institutionally, how we can affect change at a more global, national, or regional level. And we usually do that by forming organizations that have a purpose, and very often these would qualify under Mr. Bornstein's definition as social enterprises for the common good. The common good, of course, being such an important part of Catholic social teaching. And here's an example that I would like to point to, who's drawing a lot of interest these days within Catholic circles and beyond. In the wake of Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical called Caritas in Veritate, Charity in Truth, and other papal pronouncements from Pope Francis in Laudato Si and other places, people are asking questions about different ways of understanding economics that fit better with the gospel and the values that Jesus proposes in the Beatitudes, in the 25th chapter of Matthew's gospel. And some of the examples that are being used come from the Franciscan tradition. This one, maybe not a household word even in Franciscan homes, I'm not sure that we have a fraternity name for him yet, is Blessed Bernardino of Feltre. All of you who have a statue of him in your home, you'll get a free dessert with dinner. Okay. But he's interesting because what he's holding in his hand is the first example that we have of micro-lending in Western Europe. It's called the Monte di Pietà. And that thing that looks like a plum pudding with Necco wafers on it is actually representing a mountain. And the mountain, on each step going up the mountain, there's a gold coin. The gold coin stands for investment. Investment in this mountain of piety. And at the top, you have a banner with the figure of the risen Christ. So it's a symbol of victory and triumph. And at the bottom, you have a picture of a donor. That donor is an investor who invests in what was essentially the first Franciscan bank. The reason that the friars got involved in banking, you might say, well, that seems a little far from St. Francis, is because this is 1400, not 1200. The context of money and the use of money has changed dramatically in those 200 years. The big issue for the poor now is how to get access to credit. Because banks charged exorbitant rates of credit, sometimes 40 to 70%. Those who needed money and needed it desperately often went into debt to unscrupulous moneylenders and for the rest of their lives were indebted, practically slaves of the moneylenders who owned their debt. Franciscans moved aggressively into this area through the use of the sacrament of reconciliation. There were a lot of clever businessmen who were making a lot of money in very unethical business deals. And some of them had enough of a conscience that they wanted to confess it, at least on their deathbed, as they felt their toes getting a little warm at the end of the bed. And the friars, of course, would offer them absolution, but saying the condition is, are you ready to make satisfaction for the sins that you have committed against others? And there the answer is, okay, what's it going to cost me? It's up to you, but you should invest your excess wealth in the poor. That's a work of charity, and it is it's a virtuous act in the eyes of your just judge, who's about to take a good hard look at your accounting books. Bing, out comes the checkbook, and what do you know? Ding, another investor for the Monte di Pietà. The rates of exchange, or the interest rates on these loans, ran around 4%. Accessible for the poor, generally the loans were small, and because there was a large pool of investors, the risk was spread fairly evenly. There was also a high incentive to repay your loan because other people depended on your repaying your loan so they could get a loan as well. So there's strong peer pressure as well. It was a complex and sophisticated banking system. It was one which businessmen of the Middle Ages understood because it represented the gospel in terms that they understood financially. It was practical, it served the common good, and it reduced social conflict by reducing excess wealth and giving a fund to help the common good. So it was a smart way to do economics and also to keep social peace. The Monte di Pietà, the earliest one that we know, is in Perugia, and we still have a monument to it there in Piazza of Monte di Pietà. It was founded in 1460 and was a very successful operation for hundreds of years until the suppression of religious institutions in the 1870s with the Italian Revolution. This is the great Monte di Pietà of Naples. Can you see? It looks like a regular bank. This was founded in 1539 after the Montes were very well established. And you would find these throughout Italy. You still find the Monte di Pietà in Mexico. For example, there's one still in Mexico City, but it's now kind of lost its religious purpose after the Mexican revolutions of the last century, and it's now basically a pawn bank. So you can pawn things there for small loans. But the name is the old name that the friars brought with them in the 16th century, Monte di Pietà. Okay, flashing, clicking, flashing, clicking, moving. All right. But what about today? What about 2000? How would we express in our own terms of economic development and human development today some of these same values? Maybe not with the Monte di Pietà, but with something like a women's co-op snack shop and a widow's sewing cooperative in Coimbatore, India, sponsored by the Convent of the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary, once again, where they saw that women in this area of India, and particularly widows, were very, very vulnerable. At the death of their husbands, many times they would be encouraged to commit suicide so as not to be a burden on their in-laws, or simply to go back to their own families, that the husband's family no longer wanted the daughter-in-law. To preserve these women's dignity in some ways, the Franciscan sisters developed a sewing cooperative and a little snack shop where these women sell things that they make or produce at a low cost to make a small profit, and they invest their earnings in a common fund from which they can draw in order to build up a little capital to buy a new sewing machine or to open another snack shop. It's a small example of a micro economy which is sponsored by a Franciscan institution, I presume with a small initial investment. Probably the first box of snacks and probably the first sewing machine came from the sisters. But after that, the emphasis is very much on the development of the women's enterprise as something that they can do themselves by involving other poor women in these projects. If we go back to the time of Francis, one of my favorite scenes is the preaching to the birds. And I know that it's one of those scenes that sometimes people think is just a little bit cutesy, or we end up with Francis in the bird bath, which my mom had, and we all, you know, sooner or later we see it at the garden store. But it is a way in which we see, and I can tell you this, for the first time in Christian history, at least the first time in the lives of the saints, that a Christian saint addresses a non-human creature as brother and sister. Francis has an insight about these creatures' relationship to God, the Creator, but also their relationship to Christ, the firstborn of all creation, as if the elder brother of all creatures. And if he's your elder brother and he's my elder brother, guess what, Mr. Pigeon? You're my brother too, and Sister Sparrow, and I guess you can go off into seagull and albatross and other things down the list. But it's a revolutionary development in Christian spirituality, and I know because that's what I wrote my thesis about. I spent a long time figuring that out, that Francis was the first. But it's not enough simply to feed birds today. We take other expressions. And here I'd like to point out something from a former student of mine, of whom I'm very proud, an organization called Catholic Climate Covenant. This grew out of work done at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in Washington, D.C. It's about care for creation and care for the poor, making the connection between those two. And it even has a nifty little thing that some of you have probably seen called how to take the St. Francis Pledge. And this is the guy who developed it all. This is Dan Misla, a graduate of our Franciscan School of Theology, formerly in Berkeley, now down in San Diego, California. After working for many years on environmental issues for the Bishops' Conference, he founded Catholic Climate Covenant, CCC, and became its first director. He's also, I've recently met him in Rome, where he was meeting with Pope Francis and the Pontifical Academy of Sciences because of Pope Francis's interest in his encyclical Laudato Si, on how we care for our common home. So I think Dan is translating his Franciscan education. He and his wife Susie and their kids are great supporters of the Franciscan vision. The St. Francis Pledge, you can certainly find it online, but it says that we will pray and reflect on the duty to care for God's creation and to protect the poor and vulnerable. We will learn about and educate others on the causes and moral dimensions of climate change. Here with the Pope's new encyclical, we certainly have lots of material on that. And to assess how we as individuals and in our families, parishes, and other affiliations contribute to climate change by energy use, consumption, waste, etc. How we can act to change our choices and behaviors to reduce the ways we contribute to climate change, and to advocate for Catholic principles and priorities in climate change discussions and decisions, especially as they impact those who are poor and vulnerable. So, following papal magisterial teaching on issues of environment and poverty. But there's also another dimension of the world of the 13th century and our world that we've touched on here, and it is the fact of violence and warfare. This is something which Pope after Pope after Pope, from Pope John the 23rd in Pacem in Terris, Pope Paul the 6th with his heartfelt appeal at the United Nations for an end to war, Pope John Paul the 2nd, his constant pleas for peace in the world, followed by Pope Benedict and more recently Pope Francis. Somehow the world continues to be afflicted by warfare. Here, a representation of the battle at Damietta, the storming of the Tower of Damietta during the time that Francis was in Egypt. Francis, as we know, did his part to try to stop the violence of this particular war. He was not particularly successful. He saw the slaughter of the Christian troops, but he did what he could. In our day, we have organizations that also try to alleviate the harm from warfare and violence. One of them certainly is Franciscans International. I'm sure many of you know about this. It's our common voice as Franciscans at the United Nations. So it represents Franciscans from all over the world, friars, sisters, and seculars, who speak from Franciscan values to the decision-making bodies of the United Nations. They are an NGO, a non-governmental organization, so they don't have a vote in the assembly, but they can confer with members of the assembly, give advice, and propose actions. They also host educational programs. Here we see a picture of their current project, which is done in coordination with the Franciscans of the Custody of the Holy Land for the resettlement of refugees, Christian and Muslim, from Syria, particularly from the city of Aleppo. This effort for human rights is an ongoing struggle in the world. As these people leave Syria, of course, the great question becomes, where do they go? I know that in the Diocese of San Diego, we have more than 30,000 Syrian Christians who now live in the diocese. And we've just had a new Syrian bishop appointed by the Holy Father to oversee their care. Most of them are members of the Chaldean Church. We've actually had a couple of vocations to our province from these families. Desperately poor, I know secular Franciscan fraternities in our area participate in the efforts of the diocese by contributing to support a family. So there are national, global efforts and also individual local projects that help people like Syrian refugees. The Holy Land continues to be a troubled land 800 years after Francis visited Syria. If we're really honest about it, is the favorite Franciscan saint in the world Saint Clare? Sad, but probably not. Is the favorite Franciscan saint in the world really Saint Francis of Assisi? No. Who is the one that everybody loves? Tony, come around. Something's lost and must be found. My mother taught me that. And a fiver under the statue, and you light the candle, and you know, oh, my theological friends would just blush. But hey, it worked. And when my mother lost her wedding ring 2 weeks before my folks' 50th wedding anniversary, you can imagine the prayers to St. Anthony. And by about 5 days before the big mass and the family party and all like that, my dad, who was an accountant and a very thrifty Republican gentleman, my mother was a very liberal Democratic woman, and they managed to have 5 kids, so I guess they got along. He finally had to break down, and he said, I guess I'm going to have to buy you a new wedding ring. And she said, well, it would be nice, because it was really just the stone that had popped out, so there was still the setting, but without the stone, you know. So got the new ring, got it set there. 2 days before, my mother walks into the laundry room, and she claims, now this is very much my mother, God rest her, that there was a beam of light coming in the laundry room window, and it hit right in the middle of the laundry room floor, and it was sparkling all these different colors. What do you suppose does that? The original diamond. So she took it to my dad and said, well, I found the diamond, so I guess we could take back the other ring. My dad at this point, what's he going to say? Oh, great, yeah, we'll get that. We'll just go back to the... He says, why don't we just go back to the jeweler and have a setting for both stones? Oh. So he paid for the stone, he paid for the new setting. And then when they got back home, my mother's loving this big new ring. And she says, oh, honey, she said, but 10% for St. Anthony for the poor. He says, there's a surcharge. She says, oh, honey, you've got to do, you know, if you don't give the 10% to St. Anthony's bread, the deal is off and we'll lose the ring again. And he said, I had to buy the ring. I had to buy another set, and then I had to pay off St. Anthony for it. But you know what he figured? There was a reason why he was the accountant for the Archbishop of Seattle. He said, at the value of the diamond when we got married. Because that's the diamond that was lost, huh? Fair enough. Anyway, Saint, do not do this at home. We don't recommend it. What we see here and frequently in representations of Saint Anthony is Saint Anthony distributing bread to the poor, which is a very common act of charity, and you find it at Franciscan soup kitchens and dining rooms and churches around the world to this day. Basic human needs, meeting them immediately. A piece of bread, sometimes a cup of coffee, and people need at least that to make it through part of the day. But in our 21st century, we also realize that there's more to it sometimes than simply providing a piece of bread. This is an organization that was started in our province over 50 years ago called St. Anthony's Dining Room in downtown San Francisco. It's also known as San Francisco's favorite charity. I was also a member of the board there for about 9 years. This started out as bread and coffee passed from the back door of the kitchen of the friary in downtown San Francisco after World War II to returning vets who had no job, no money, and no future. They were on the streets. This was humiliating for them, but it was also kind of life and death. They just needed some food. As those numbers grew, the friars eventually took over a garage next door, got the local secular Franciscan fraternity involved, so the sandwich making, the coffee making, became part of the regular job of the St. Boniface fraternity, which was bilingual already in those days. Heilige Bonifaz Kloster. It was a German-speaking parish. And they also spoke some English. These folks began the nucleus of what is now called St. Anthony Foundation. It went from the dining room, which now serves 3,000 meals a day, mostly now to hungry young families. It's no longer old men who are on the street, homeless. These are now people on the verge of homelessness who have to make the decision every month either to pay the rent or buy groceries for the kids. So those are our new clients. But besides that, now there's an employment office where people learn some basic job skills. There's a shower and sanitation facility. There's a laundry where people can wash their clothes. There is a Dress for Success kind of fashion store where if you're going for a job interview, you get some decent clothes and you get coached on how you should go through the interview. There's a shelter for mentally handicapped homeless women who are very often a very vulnerable public there. And there are programs for recovery from addiction, alcohol and drugs. There is a shelter, just an overnight shelter in the church, actually early morning shelter, where people can simply come in and sleep in the church from 7 in the morning until noon, just so they have a safe place to sleep. The front 10 pews are for people attending Mass, and the back 40 pews are for people who need a good night's sleep. And the two get along pretty happily together, except when people either in the front or the back have visions and hear voices. And then, well, it's downtown San Francisco. So this organization now operates on an $8 million annual budget that comes completely from private donations, and we don't receive a cent from any government agency, and we've always said that we wouldn't. It is a favorite charity of Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, atheists, and agnostics in San Francisco, of which there are many of each of those varieties. But it's because I think people see a genuine need being met without any ulterior motive. All are welcome is really the message there. There are many examples like that in other parts of the Franciscan world that you would know here in your southeast region, and I don't know at all. But I simply want to conclude these presentations today by saying that we belong to a great tradition that has always done a good job of translating the gospel into terms that our century, our generation can understand. We've tried to do that faithfully and perpetually over the years, sometimes better than others, but at least we've always tried to do it sincerely and always with joy. Amen. Thank you very much.